Welcome to the Mustang Champions Insights Podcast, connecting audiences with those who work with, train, and compete with American Mustangs. Join us as we talk to fellow Mustang champions about their perspectives and experiences in working with Mustangs as companions and champions. Here's your host, Matt Manroe.
I would like to welcome you to the Mustang Champions Inside Podcast. Mustang Champions, if you don't know, it is a nonprofit working in partnership with the Bureau of Land Management, Wild Horse and Burro Program, and we help them get Mustangs that have been gathered and off the range, get them adopted and purchased and what we say into private care or into homes. My name is Matt Manroe. I am the Executive Director of Mustang Champions, and with this podcast, we just hope to introduce you to people from different backgrounds and experiences that currently own or have worked with and trained Mustangs for competitions or for workhorses or just to be great companion horses. Because we really want you to understand the differences between Mustangs and domestic horses that someday you will own a Mustang of your own. I am here today with Jenny Luciette. I know and have known her for many years. We have worked together to try to promote Mustang adoption. She has educated me on the range as we filmed Horses in the Wild. I know her to be a true advocate and champion for the American Mustang. Welcome, Jenny.
I am so pleased to be with you. It's been a while since we've seen each other face to face, but gosh, you know, thinking back, I bet I met you almost 15 years ago. I think filming.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. Totally, totally amazing. So I would like to start off, if it's okay with you, just talking a little bit about with your experience of growing up with horses.
Oh gosh. You know, I come from a military background. My father was special ops, and also I am a first generation American. People, you know, are kind of shocked by that, but my father's from France. My mother's from Poland. And we actually, my father's side came here after World War II as a teenager, where his father was the French delegate to write the Marshall Plan. So a lot of history behind me and a lot of misinformation is out there about World War II and growing up in that area. And of course, my father, his father was a big businessman in France. And so when World War II hit, he decided to buy a farm and move their family to a great little island called Normandy. So they saw the midst of that. So long story short, you know, my background, family deep, is farming, ranching, community, small farms, that sort of stuff. So even though we moved around slightly in military because of special ops, you don't move that much. The horses really became almost like my babysitter. And so I started riding at a very, very young age and did some riding in Germany when we were there. And then when we came back to the States is when I went full-fledged. And this is where you and I kind of connected, is I started riding in the English form. I was open jumping and doing a lot of equestrian. And I swear on that. Now being out in the West, you know, I mainly focus on Western riding. I've done roping. I've even gotten on a couple bulls or two.
Wow. So, yeah. Well, that's so great.
I know. Let's talk craziness, but yeah, that's a whole nother story. But, you know, I swear on the English side of riding. It really teaches you a lot about balance and trusting that horse and utilizing your body and muscles instead of hands and feet. So it has done me a world of difference when I got into roping and really on that Western end.
So how did you get connected to Mustangs?
Oh gosh, another long story, and kind of dates back to my history. 9/11 hit me. My father was special ops and focused on terrorism. So I was out here in Nevada, of course, saw a lot of, I call them wild horses, you know, out on the range here in Reno, Nevada. They are 50% of the BLM's Mustangs roam free out here, along with tribal lands, state horses, everything else. So after 9/11, it hit me hard, and I made a crazy decision to sell my house, go to DC, learn what I could in DC, and come back and apply for a job with the state. Well, DC sucked me in. And I'm going to sit there and say it, you know, I was in the right place at the right time and was real naive about politics back then, which actually did me a lot of good. People noticed what a hard worker I was. I'd never been in government workforce. I'd always worked in the private sector. And so, you know, let's face it, private sector makes money and government spends money. And so, you know, my mindset was that private sector mindset. And no matter what, I always put 100% into everything I was doing. And it followed me well. So getting into the wild horse end now politically, I first started contracting, but was quickly picked up by some major contractors, worked for the Library of Congress, the Department of State, and then a small initiative called the Millennium Challenge Corporation. And that's when I was asked to talk to the White House and about becoming a political appointee, because at that time I was supporting the CEO of that initiative who sat on the cabinet. And after many times of trying to find someone to replace me as a political, he wrote back and said, "I've got who I want. Now we need to make her a political appointee so it fits the administration." So that's how I came into the government officially. And when he left the Millennium Challenge Corporation, that whole team leaves. The next person comes in and they bring in their team of people. So when that occurred, the White House came back to me and said, "Okay, you know, what's your next job? You're a political appointee now," and offered me some really lucrative international positions. And naive me said, "You know, I want to get back to Nevada one day."
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm interested in the Department of Ag or Department of Interior. And as the 10 people in the room were looking through my resume, all of a sudden they started whispering and said, "We'll be right back." And I thought, oh gosh, now I've really made somebody mad. They were gone about half hour, 45 minutes, came back in the room and said, "Hey, we've got this new position with the Bureau of Land Management. And seeing your resume that you ran horse ranches and have been a part of that community, the horsing and ranching and farming community, with your experience with horses, there's a job at the Bureau of Land Management." And it happened to be the same year that it was the last amendment to the Wild Horse and Burro Act. And I highly recommend anybody listening to this, if you haven't read that act yet, read it. It's really important to understand that act. It's only 8 pages long, and it will kind of educate you when you start seeing things on social media of what the laws are, what the mandates are, and what the limitations are. So they offered me an interview, went in and interviewed. And again, you know, you run into people all the time and it becomes a small world. And it just so happened, one of my best friends at the Millennium Challenge Corporation used to work with the chief of staff and the assistant director in New Mexico. So needless to say, that interview went very well. And that assistant director at the time really wanted someone from the West in this position. So that's how my career really began.
And how many years were you with the Wild Horse and Burro program?
So I was with the government for 20 years, and I'm going to say it's been over 18 years directly associated in that program itself. And the unique thing on that is I started in Washington, D.C. So not only was I put in a position at the beginning as a political appointee, but then, gosh, less than a year and a half later, I actually applied to be a civil servant and took care of their budget, did a lot of legislation work, policy work, wrote testimony, walked the halls of Congress, and really got a quick education on how the government really works. From there, I came back to Nevada and did a couple details as not only the state lead in Nevada, but also as the deputy chief for the entire program for On Range. So really started understanding the rangeland management side of it, environmental assessments, things that worked, really looked into the history, and then was also the state lead for Wyoming. So two of the largest programs. So again, just very lucky to be able to say I didn't do my whole career in one position, that I really got the full gamut of it. And bottom line, I ended my career, I kind of went backwards. I ended my career as a public affairs specialist that just focused on the horse program, where we wrote a lot of policy to ensure that there was consistency across all the states. That was adopted by the horse program and today still runs the same way, so that people aren't talking out of two sides of their mouth. Sure, things are going to happen, but management in 10 states can get very complex and very complicated.
Well, I know also that you spent a lot of hours being a part of gathers.
Oh, gosh. I can sit here and say I've been over 100 plus gathers. And gosh, I want to say almost every state. Can't think of one off my head that I wasn't, but quite a bit in Wyoming, quite a bit in Nevada, and then a little bit in Utah, or again, Arizona helped with all that. So really saw burros and horses.
So this is where I think you're very unique and rare in your experience and your point of view on the health of the range and the managing of wild horses and burros, which I know is not an easy problem to solve.
You know, gosh, I was part... try to go back and do it as short as possible, but I was part of the first team that did an agreement with a group such as yours, the Mustang Champions. And a matter of fact, you ended up joining that contract for several years and made a huge difference in that. And so when we started really seeing a lot of horses coming into holding, and I want to be clear, you know, you got to remember, as a government employee, even though you're under a law, every time the administration changes, and it doesn't matter what side, your priorities change. So I think the biggest thing for people to understand is that this program is extremely complex. It's not just about gathers and adoptions, but those are the greatest tools to use, especially today. But remember, it's called the Bureau of Land Management. They manage the lands. And why is that so extremely important is because people really need to, instead of jumping into conversations or using that emotion, really need to understand the complexities of land management. Bottom line, think about it. If our land and our public lands are so damaged, kind of like, look at the California Trail, you can still see the ruts from 100 years ago of wagons coming across. That land is dead. It can't produce plants anymore. You've wiped out, you know, somewhat of those plants already, and they're not going to come back. And so you really have to start at the basis of it. Just like us as humans, if you're not eating and drinking, you're not going to live very long. And I think the second thing that is the hardest thing for people to understand is that the Bureau of Land Management is what they call a multiple use agency. So every bit of that land is dedicated to something to be utilized in balance. And you'll see that over and over in the act. It has to be a balance in that land use in order for it to succeed and also be able to thrive. And I hope that makes sense to people, because I really want everybody, and it doesn't matter where you stand emotionally, you've got to understand why these laws are in place, because this isn't about just today. It is about our future generations. And when I'm living in a state now, Nevada, which has the lowest rainfall per year, and I'm telling you, we're talking, you know, 7 to 10 inches a year is the rainfall here. So it's a very, very sensitive and delicate landscape. And then you start bringing in things in the wildlife side that are threatened or endangered, and we got to balance out the use of that land. And over the 18 plus years I was with the Bureau, whenever we were talking about urban growth or threatened or endangered species or things like that, the horse program has always gotten a buy. And when I say a buy is, I'd sit there in big meetings and they'd go, okay, you know, rangeland management, where can you let go of some of the money for this initiative? Or, you know, oil and gas, we're only going to do so many things. Or, you know, wildlife, you know, where can we take some of those seeding projects and take some of that money for this initiative? And, oh, by the way, we're not going to touch the horses. And so on top of already having to balance anything new coming in, now, when the horses still aren't balanced on the range, it's like a domino effect. It's going to affect every other program out there. And at the end of the day, it's going to affect what is the solid foundation of everything, and that's our lands.
So with this point of view that you have, you were involved in a documentary.
Oh, yes.
That's called Hellbent, that Boot Barn produced. And talk a little bit about what that documentary has meant to you, and what you think the documentary might be able to influence as far as awareness to the current state of rangeland and the American Mustang.
So you got to think about this. I mean, first off, there's such a long story behind that, because I was advising with Hellbent, or with Boot Barn, when they came forth with this. And I'm going to tell you the truth, I had zero trust in them. I've spent my years dealing with all different types of people. And the biggest thing is having to manage what I call large packs. I mean, we've got horse advocates out there, such as you. You're truly advocating for that animal. You're putting in time and effort to get them adopted. You're not dumping them on people. You've got all kinds of, I mean, just the relationships that are built with the trainers to help others, to ensure that that animal not only is productive, but is going to have a good foundation to lead into its future life. On the other hand, there's what I, now that I don't work for the government, I don't have a problem saying, we've also got folks just like bad ranchers and good ranchers. There are hardcore animal activists and large, large PACs, political affiliated corporations, that make tens of millions of dollars off of this program. And I say this program, and I mean off of the horses' backs, because none of those dollars actually go back into rangeland health, adopting horses, back into the horses' health, any of that stuff. So before we get into Hellbent, I want to point that out is, you know, I really want folks, and especially your folks, which have been the greatest ambassadors we've ever had, to really do your research. If you're not sure of something, there's so many people to ask the question to ensure we're not spreading misinformation on social media. So when Hellbent came in, I pretty much felt in my deep soul that the Boot Barn had been somewhat paid off to do a documentary or a movie or something by one of those activist groups. And so I was very standoffish at first about it. But as we started talking about it, I realized what their marketing program was really to do what we do. And I'm saying the big picture is really promote the Western heritage, the Western lifestyle, utilizing the animals appropriately so that they're happy. And then that led into another huge organization, Step Studios, which is an international filmmaker. And they literally came together, and their point is what I'm saying, a soft approach. I encourage people to watch it. There was 56 hours of film and 7 months of editing for a less than 13-minute documentary. And this documentary is focused on kind of where we're at today. There's a huge division across the country that are so divided that they won't sit down and have a conversation. And that documentary truly is about having a hardcore conversation about the challenges that is happening within this horse program. And it's not just the horse program, it's the effects of everything else due to the constant overpopulation. At the end of the day, our rangelands in the largest state and in many of the other states, not so much in, you know, those smaller states that may have one or two herd management areas, but when you're looking at Wyoming and Nevada and Utah, even Oregon and Arizona, you're seeing some real effects happening because there is not a balance on the range. And it goes into, this is one of those acts that was a feel-good act. It was during the worst time in our history, the Vietnam War. It's one of the only acts that was ever passed 100%. And I'm going to share some information. I was able to sit down with many congressmen and senators that were part of passing that act. And every single one of them stated to me that never in 1,000 years was there any conversation about having to ever adopt horses or even hold any horses. They thought it was going to be as simple as kind of like managing wildlife. And that if horses, I don't even know if that discussion came up for at least 3 to 4 years, but if horses were gathered, if they maintained the numbers on the land, they could easily move these horses to the old Mustangers. Because again, people think Mustangers just wanted to kill and slaughter horses. And the facts are about 75% of those horses became using stock and or were sold to other people that didn't have the ability to train them. So a lot of misinformation has been presented over the years, and it's locked in people's mind. You say something over and over again, people are going to believe it.
Right.
And so when it comes down to Hellbent, the other big structure of this, I put that out there. You know, 56 hours of film and 7 months of editing for a 13-minute film was to really capture that critical point we're at today. And the ones that are hurting are the horses and the wildlife and our plants, of course, in riparian areas. But when you're talking about breathing animals, that's what's hurting. And it's devastating. The things that I've seen out on the range that a normal person doesn't see, it's hard to sleep at night.
Well, the documentary is terrific. It is winning awards. It is continuing to be accepted into multiple film festivals. And how can I best watch it today?
So, thank you for acknowledging. Yes, it's gotten a lot of acknowledgments in the three film festivals. It just got accepted into the London Film Festival and the San Diego Film Festival, which are coming up in the next month or so. But if anybody wants to see this, all you got to do is type in Boot Barn, do an underscore, straight line, Hellbent, and it'll pop up Boot Barn Hellbent. You click on that link, you scroll to the middle of the page, and that documentary is sitting on Boot Barn's blog site. So it's free to the public now. It was held back for several months, but it's been out almost a month now. And it really is amazing how much people are viewing this, because it's not a sit-down movie. Think about social media nowadays and even podcasts. People listen to podcasts as they're driving because that's a long drive, but hardly anybody really is sitting in front of a computer. So it's really showing, we had a lot of conservation groups involved in that, a lot of locals here, also hunting and fishing folks, everybody from every side, even some real hardcore horse advocates, and I'm going to say advocates, that were a part of this, where we actually were able to sit down and have some real conversations and focus on, you know, knowing that it's likely to get harder emotionally before it gets better. But if we don't address this today, I feel that if it continues on the path it's going, that our grandchildren and children are going to have to be like they are in Asian countries, in China and Japan, where the only time they even see an animal is going to be in a zoo. And I don't think that's what anybody wants.
Right.
So please do watch that and just take pieces of it and utilize that in your everyday life.
So, personal question, how many Mustangs do you think you have adopted in your lifetime?
Well, I personally have adopted three. Currently, I have an amazing little guy. You know, I'm an old lady now. I'm done with training horses. And my main thing was, when I was looking for an additional horse after I retired one of my horses, I put out there that, I'm not going to lie about this, I wanted more woe than go, and I wanted something shorter because I was always a 16 to 17 hand horse rider. And matter of fact, one of the trainers that has been in many of your shows, the Zimmermans, called me up and said that they had had a horse was about to be returned, that someone had adopted it for one of the challenges that they dealt with. And the person that had it just didn't click with them. Sent me a picture and actually had just posted it on their site. I immediately called them and said, take the picture down. You know me better than anybody. I trust what you've got. You know my riding ability. You know what I can and can't handle. And I sent him and did a complete overview of him on a veterinarian side before signing off to buy him. And I did that because he came out of Eureka, Nevada during an emergency gather. So I had some concerns after talking to many people, even Bobby Kerr, God rest his soul, good, good friend of mine, that there could be some organ damage to that animal. So I wanted it, you know, really checked out. I'd been on that gather. A lot of the horses looked great and a lot of them didn't. So I had the luxury at the time to spend that kind of money. And if you've got that luxury, you know, have your animals checked out. Because again, it's not fair to the animal if there is some underlying condition to put them through a hardcore training. But there's a lot of people that just want them in their backyards. And so my little guy is on top of it. I like my browns, bays, and blacks. That's my first choice of horses. They've always been the greatest in the mindset and have done me well. But this little guy is a curly gray. He's about 14 hands, both tall and wide, built like a tank. The walls of his feet are about an inch thick.
Wow.
I put shoes on him one time and it was the worst thing I ever did to him, because it ended up cracking his feet, because that ring was so solid that it wouldn't allow it to continue to grow and expand.
Didn't need him.
Yeah. Yeah. So
the Mustang.
I know, I'm telling you, I really lucked out. But I take this horse. He's done 2 years of our Reno Rodeo cattle drive, which is a 5-day drive over 50 miles in ranges that are volcanic rock in some cases, or deep sand, heavy hills, everything. And I'll tell you what, not only am I riding him on that, but I'm also bringing together, I'm a host, excuse me, for a team of anywhere from 8 to 10 people that pay to go on this cattle drive. So we have 60 paying guests that want a little bit of that Western history. And what this also gave me the ability to showcase, not just talk about, but to showcase what an incredible animal that this, in some cases, hoof rat out on the desert, because there's a million of them, can be. And
Fantastic.
it's so funny to see how affectionate people are, and incredible how much he is affectionate to people, because he was on the range half his life. He's only 8, and he was in Eureka, Nevada for over 4 years. So the other, misinformation that goes out there, he was gathered by helicopter. And currently, both our sheriff's office, Reno Rodeo, always takes drones out during this cattle drive as a marketing ploy, and are constantly asking me to be able to go and get the cows down in huge ditches that we go through, because they can literally fly that drone right over the head of my horse. And if anything, he'll look up and look at it. And that's it. And I saw that often with Bobby Kerr's horses. Fireworks, explosions, they are not scared to death of helicopters. Could there be one that is afraid of noises? Of course, they're all different. But that is not true. You're seeing magic marketing pictures when it looks like the helicopter's on top of them. You show me one of those pictures that's being posted, and I'll probably show you 10 other from the side view where that helicopter's a mile away. So.
Well, I know Mustangs to be amazing. I own two. I have the honor of getting to produce events to promote how talented they are, and I know that you have lived the life and you have the passion and are absolutely an advocate for the American Mustang.
I really am. I mean, and being retired, most people go into retirement and they walk away from their jobs. I am probably twice as busy as I was when I was working. And my average work week was 40 to 60 hours on an average, because of gathers and special events. I help promote the big prison down here, the Carson City, the Northern Nevada Correctional Center, that has over 25 years of experience in that prison program. Again, I've had the great opportunity to go to several of your shows. I think one of the times that we really got to know each other was when you were here in Reno, Nevada, in the mid, I think it was 2015 to 17, where the Reno Rodeo put on a big Mustang show, and you were promoting that. So, what your organization has done and will continue to do, has changed not only the numbers of horses adopted, but the success of it. And it's really opened that door to people that didn't even realize there was wild horses on the range. So I'm thankful for what you've done, and the fact that you don't promote it in a nefarious way. You promote the truth. You really push toward the education I think we learn daily from every single trainer that goes through your program.
I agree.
There's something to continue to learn. So for me to walk away from this after so many years being so involved, I just don't see it happening. So I do have the luxury now. I mean, I was never really held back in the government, but I now have the luxury to speak for all the effects that it has, not only on the horses, but our rangelands and the other 900 species of wildlife and 3,200 species of plants. And we've got to make sure that they all work together in a balance.
Well, thank you for what you have done. Thank you for what you are doing and have yet to do. It is quite the community of people that are all in, you know, from my experience, everybody really wants the best, no matter your point of view. So it is all about caring for and perpetuating the livelihood of our American Mustangs.
It is. We need those healthy horses again. We were almost at appropriate management levels in 2007. It jumped up, and we're just talking the Bureau of Land Management. That number on the range jumped up to 95,000, and I believe it was 2020 or 2022. And over the last 5 years, we're seeing that going down. And also, we're seeing the adoption numbers, again, because of great groups like you, go up. So I want to just state something for people to really look at and think about. If we have these horses at the balance, at their appropriate management levels on the range, we wouldn't have to gather the tens of thousands of horses a year. We would literally only be needing to gather anywhere from 3,500 to 5,000 a year, which, by the way, adoptions last year were over, I think it was 6,300 horses adopted. So let's all work toward getting to that goal. And also, you know, there are horses sitting in holding pastures that are over the age of 30 that literally don't have teeth and are dying a slow death. Understand that. Yes, with water, without water, that horse will succumb within 48 to 72 hours. But because of the size of the animal, people don't realize it's starving to death, and it can take up to a year. And I will sit here and stand behind it every time. If anybody thinks that's a humane way of life, it isn't. And I would not want to see that again on any animal. And there was a time where they were healthy on the range overall. Some are still very healthy on the range, but where they're not, it's horrible to see. So keep doing what you're doing. I am thankful to every single trainer, every single person that supported your group. And you know me, I'm always going to promote what you guys have done. And that it does. It comes down to people like you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you. And thank you for joining us on this podcast and sharing some of your experience and knowledge and certainly your passion. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for tuning in to the Mustang Champions Insights podcast. We hope you enjoyed this insightful journey into the world of the American Mustang. Please share this episode and contact Matt anytime at matt.manro@mustangchampions.org. And join us again for another episode of the Mustang Champions Insights podcast on the Equus Radio Network.